You might recognize this. This is a Google Earth map of the Middle Eastern area. And as the sermon last week, as the sermon this week, you see that we're beginning to focus in on the spring holy days. And I will be focusing in on the spring holy days as well. And I'm going to be talking some about the Exodus. Now, I was thinking, this would be a good sermon to give as we lead up to the spring holy days. So I started working on it, and pretty soon it was two sermons. Later on, it was three sermons. And so anyway, we'll start today and see how far we can get. But, you know, it's interesting when you start looking into the Exodus events and what the, quote, experts say and believe about it. There's not a lot that people agree on. As a matter of fact, I can kind of outline right here, looking at the map, telling you what everybody pretty much agrees on concerning the Exodus. Now, they all agree that this is the Nile Valley and the Nile River, and then this is Egypt in this area, that this is the land of Goshen here, that this is the Red Sea, this is the Gulf of Suez, and this is the Gulf of Aqaba, the two fingers coming off the Red Sea, that this is Sinai Peninsula, that this is the land of Canaan, which was possessed by the Philistines, the Moabites, the Ammonites, the Amalekites, and so forth. And this is Midian over in this area and here. And that's pretty much all the experts agree on. I've covered all the things that they agree on. Question is, why do they disagree on so many different things? And that's what I want to explore today. For example, let me just give you a couple of examples here. Exactly where is the mountain of God, for example? Now, the traditional location, Mount Sinai, as it's referred to, but I'm going to try to refer to it as the Mountain of God, is in the southern part of the Sinai Peninsula. And there's that's pretty much the traditional place. But then some people say, nope, it's over on the other side of the Gulf of Aqaba. There's a mountain over there is about the same height as Mount Sinai. That's called Mount Laws, L-A-W-Z. And some people say, yeah, that's where it is. Now, there are even a few people who will say, no, it's way up here somewhere around Mount Or or somewhere up in this area, one of these mountains. But mainly it's the discussion between these two locations, the traditional site or a site over on the other side of the Gulf of Aqaba in Midian. And then there's the crossing. Now, a lot of the experts love the idea that the crossing was not across a sea, but across some freshwater lakes up near the land of Goshen. Now, these freshwater lakes, and this was mentioned a little bit in the sermonette by Mr. Sanders, very shallow. At most of these areas are maybe 3 feet deep. As a matter of fact, reading about this lake area and the land of Goshen, it kind of reminds me of Louisiana. Basically a swamp. It's not really anything else. Now, there's the Great Bitter Lake is more like a lake, but it's mostly swamp areas that are, you know, a foot, 2 foot, sometimes 3 feet deep, and that's about it. So that's one area, but then another area is somewhere near the upper tip of the Gulf of Suez that they cross there. And then there's some that believe that, no, they weren't heading to the Sinai in the Sinai Peninsula. They were heading over to Midian and Mount Laws, and they crossed at the mouth of the Gulf of Aqaba. And then some say, no, that's not where they did it. They crossed somewhere up around the midpoint of the Gulf of Aqaba, and again heading towards Mount Laws. So there's a lot of different theories and so forth, and nobody really seems to agree or come up with the strong enough evidence to convince everybody that, no, this is the situation. Now, what we do know, And what we do agree on is Exodus 16, verse 3, among other things in the Bible, that this was a very important event for God. In Exodus 16, 3, he says, "You shall eat no leavened bread with it. 7 days you shall eat unleavened bread with it, that is the bread of affliction, for you came out of the land of Egypt in haste, that you may remember the day in which you came out of the land of Egypt all the days of your life." So it was so important to God. He said, we're making a feast, a holy days, a set of holy days out of this occasion. 7 days. Well, you throw in the Passover, it's actually 8 days of a spring festival, with the first and last day of unleavened bread being holy days. So that's how important it was to God. So it was pretty important. And so it's worth looking into this in more detail. So if you want a title for this sermon and a couple more to follow, The Miracle of the Exodus, and this is part one. And what I'm going to do is look at a number of questions and answer them in the next several sermons. Questions about the Exodus. And let me just briefly run through them here, but we'll go through each one of these in detail, so you don't have to write them all down right now. But the first one is pretty fundamental. Why were the Israelites in slavery to start with? What's going on here? Why were they in slavery? A second question that comes up, and this was discussed a little bit in the sermonette also. For a minute there, I thought Mr. Sanders was going to steal my sermon, but he didn't. But there's this debate over natural explanations of miracles versus true miracles of God. Why? What is this all about? Because you really see it when it relates to the Exodus, because there were a bunch of miracles there, as Mr. Sanders just talked about a few of them. And then there's some people say, there wasn't an Exodus. Come on, get real. Millions of people crossing a desert, they'd be dead before they got halfway across. And so they say, no Exodus. And then is there a biblical date for the Exodus? And this I've answered before, but I'm going to briefly review that, because we can pin down a pretty decent date for the Exodus. Was Ramses the Pharaoh of the Exodus? Come on. Everybody knows that Ramses was the Pharaoh, unless you've never seen the Ten Commandments movie. But we'll look at that issue. Number six, did the Hebrews live in the city of Ramses? And again, I've addressed this a little bit in sermons a few years ago, and we'll talk about where they actually lived. How many Hebrews departed in the Exodus? What's the numbers? It ranged from a low of maybe, 20,000 or so, to 3 million or so. Can we come up with a reasonable number? We'll look at that. And then there's the question of where's the Red Sea? Now, we know the Israelites crossed the Red Sea. Where is the Red Sea? Is it the Gulf of Suez, the Gulf of Aqaba, is it those shallow lakes? Or is it the Red Sea itself, as we showed you on that map? We'll look at that. And then the question of where is the mountain of God? Horeb, sometimes referred to, Mount Sinai. Where really is it? Does the Bible really tell us? And then did the Israelites come to cross the Red Sea near Goshen? So we're going to look at four possible crossing sites, the four I showed you. The one at Goshen, the one at the tip of the Gulf of Suez, the one at the mouth of the Gulf of Aqaba, and the one at the kind of midpoint of the Gulf of Aqaba. We'll look at all of those possible crossings and talk about the pros and the cons of each of those. And then finally, we'll end up with answering this question, hopefully. Can we determine the true Red Sea crossing from the evidence we have? So that's kind of the plan of the future here. But today, we're going to look at these first seven questions. We're only going to get that far today. So let's begin with the first question. Why were the Israelites in slavery to start with? And the normal answer, well, yeah, there's some bad Pharaoh came along who didn't know anything about Joseph and what he had done for Egypt. And so he put them all in slavery because they were growing. And God was surprised. He said, wait a minute, this is not what I planned. Where did this Pharaoh come from? This is not working out like I wanted it. Is that what happened? Or did something else happen? Well, I'm going to look at Ezekiel 20, verses 6 through 10 here in just a moment. But leading up to this passage, the elders had come to Ezekiel to inquire of the Lord, is what it lead in to these particular verses. Why were they inquiring of the Lord? Because they had been into a forced exodus out of Israel, and they were over in Babylon, and they had some problems with this. Why would God do this to us? That's what they're coming to find out. What's going on here, God? And so God told Ezekiel what to say to them in Exodus 20, beginning in verse 6. God said, say this, on the day that I raised my hand in an oath to them to bring them out of the land of Egypt and into the land that I had searched out for them, flowing with milk and honey, the glory of all lands, then I said to them, each of you throw away the abominations which you have before his eyes and do not defile yourselves with the idols of Egypt. And there it is. What did the Israelites do in Egypt? They become Egyptianized. They begin to follow the gods of Egypt. They begin to believe in that stuff. Continuing on, I am the Lord your God, but they rebelled against me and would not obey me. They did not all cast away the abominations which were before their eyes, nor did they forsake the idols of Egypt. Then I said, I will pour out my fury on them and fulfill my anger against them in the midst of the land of Egypt. That's why they became slaves. Not because of some new Pharaoh, but because God said, you've turned to the idols of Egypt. But I acted for my name's sake, that it should not be profaned before the Gentiles, among whom they were, in whose sight I had made myself known to them to bring them out of the land of Egypt. Therefore, I made them go out of the land of Egypt and brought them into the wilderness. He said, I almost thought about not bringing them out. It was so bad. But God says, I made that promise to Abraham, and I keep my word. And so he brought them out. But that was the problem. Now look at Joshua 24, verse 15. This is Joshua's farewell address. His farewell address. And he says in Joshua 24, 15, as a challenge to them, really, he said, and if it seems evil to you to serve the Lord, choose for yourselves this day whom you will serve, whether the gods which your fathers served that were on the other side of the river. Okay, that's one choice. What our ancestors did on the other side of the Nile when they were in Egypt, you can serve those gods, or the gods of the Amorites in whose land you dwell. But for me and my house, we will serve the Lord. Same reasoning. They turned to the gods of Egypt and didn't stay faithful to the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. That was the problem. Now, it's interesting that Joshua died at 110. He was probably, and this is just a speculation, but he was probably pretty young when they left Egypt. I would speculate maybe around 25 or so. He was an assistant to Moses. One occasion he went up in the mountain with Moses. But let's look at that for a moment. If he was around 25 at the Exodus, 40 years later, that would put him at around 65. And he lived to be 110, and that's another 40 years that he lived after they went into the land of Canaan. A long time, but so it's likely that Well, when they crossed, he was the second adult alive that went through the Red Sea. The second to the last adult alive that went through the Red Sea. There was one that survived longer than Joshua. Caleb. There were the last two. Everybody 20, and by adult I mean 20 and older, everybody 20 and older had died before they got to this point where they were right here. And so if we consider 20-year-old adults, and I will refer to those below 20 as children in this and other sermons, no offense, but just consider it that not only do you, I will refer to you as you under 20 teens as children, your parents are going to refer to you as children the rest of your lives, so just get used to it. But look at Numbers 33 and verse 4. For the Egyptians were burying all their firstborn, whom the Lord had killed among them. Also, on their gods, the Lord had executed judgments. Now, this is pointing out, it wasn't just the Egyptians or the Pharaoh that was the problem. It was the gods of Egypt that was the problem. And why was that a problem? Because that had lured the Hebrews into worshiping false gods. And so there was some of these plagues came down on the Hebrews as well as the Egyptians. But God was going to preserve them, and so that didn't last. So let's look at Exodus 8:22. And in that day I will set apart the land of Goshen, in which my people dwell, that no swarms of flies shall be there, in order that you may know that I am the Lord in the midst of the land. Now this is a message to Israel. He's telling them, you have messed up. And I've laid these first plagues on you as well. The first three plagues I've laid on you, just like I laid on the Egyptians, because I want to get your attention. I want you to understand, you have been serving the wrong gods. You've been serving the gods of Egypt. You need to get refocused on the God of Jacob, of the God of Israel. And so he was getting their attention. But then when that fourth plague came, the flies, that wasn't on them. And the successive plagues were not on them. It was only on the Egyptians. Exodus 16:23. Then he said to them, this is what the Lord has said. Tomorrow is the Sabbath rest, a holy Sabbath to the Lord. Bake what you will bake today, and boil what you will boil, and lay up for yourselves all that remains to be kept until morning. So, of course, this is the manna incident, as had the sermonette on. But what is he saying here? You don't even know when the Sabbath is. How dumb are you? Not only do you go worship those gods of Egypt, you're so dumb you don't know the Sabbath and don't know which day it is. And so he had to use that occasion to identify for them and start their calendar clicking as far as the Sabbath is concerned. Now, let's go to the second question. Now we cleared up exactly what the problem was with the Israelites and why they were in slavery to start with. You know, if they continue serving God, that had probably made out okay. They would have prospered, and at some point God would have led them out and worked it out. That was his plan in any case. But they had to kind of learn the hard way. So my second question here is, what's the big deal about this debate of natural phenomena versus miracles? And it really comes up when you read the experts, what the experts say about the Exodus. Now, this is where I get a little bit sneaky, because the answer to this question ties in with my last series of sermons on the myths of materialism. And I left out one myth. Didn't have quite much time to work it in. And that's myth number 9. I gave you 8 myths of materialism. Myth number 9, actions by God or any other spiritual entity cannot be genuine because it contravenes the fundamental laws of nature. And so that's the reason why people don't like miracles of the Exodus, because the materialist doesn't believe in miracles. And most of the people that deal with the Exodus are basically materialists. They may say they believe in God, but it's kind of that God that once he created the earth or the universe, he backed off and hasn't done anything since, and it just runs on his own. That kind of God is what they talk about. You might recall the other eight. I just throw them up here. The first three basically centered around there is no God. The next three centered around that we're pretty much biological robots. And then myth eight, that humans, excuse me, myth seven, there are no absolute truths, but myth eight, humans can kind of figure out enough to get by, that kind of thing. But myth nine, that's the last of the myths. Let's look at that for just a moment. The doctrine of materialism is that there's no such thing as a miracle. And why the resistance to the idea of miracles? Now, it's not like we don't see them today. And I don't just mean in the Church of God. If you ever, as a matter of fact, it wasn't too long ago, maybe about a year ago, that they were getting ready to embalm this woman. She was in the mortuary. She'd been declared dead by medical experts. She woke up. And that's not the first time this happened. Yeah. Now, the argument is, well, she wasn't really dead. The medical experts just can't tell when somebody's a dead or alive. Well, that's kind of pushing it in my mind. But you know, so things like that have happened. How about someone with a terminal disease the doctors have given up on that is suddenly healed? You know, that's happened. Those are documented. Or there was even a case years ago that I read about where a guy fell out of an airplane thousands of feet high and survived, and it was documented. Turns out he fell through some trees into a huge snowbank and survive. But I don't know whether falling into some trees or a huge snowbank from thousands of feet high would survive, and no matter what the situation was. But anyway, things like that have happened. And then, of course, there's the greatest miracle of them all, the 1960 U.S. hockey win over the Russians. Well, maybe I'm stretching it a little bit on that one. But the idea that there are no miracles, it's, you know, we see them. They happen from time to time. Now, the question that we need to really think about is kind of, you know, saying there's no miracles, that's a difficult, negatives are difficult to prove. They're very difficult to prove. And there are witnesses around to some of these things. And so we see them. But let's look at the miracles of the Old Testament for a moment. I've got in the front of my Bible, I've got a subject index. And one of the subjects is miracles. And they list all the miracles of the Old Testament in a separate heading, all the miracles of the New Testament. And here's what they listed. The miracle, and I've broke it down into two categories here. Miracles that violate the laws of nature. You know, like the sun standing still, say, something like that. There were 180 of those that plain and simply just violated the laws of nature. And then I counted another 24 that, you know, you could kind of say, well, this didn't violate the laws of nature, like hail coming, right, coming down and destroying a city or something like that. Well, that could possibly be nature. But so that was a total of 204 miracles. I think that's undercount. Some of the things that we recognize as miracles, most people would not. But anyway, that's a lot of miracles. And then just look at the ones associated with the Exodus. I've listed 16 here. I won't read through them all. But Mr. Sanders was trying to steal my sermon by talking about how this is explained away by the water turning to blood. The explanation for that is that there was some volcano that erupted over in across the Mediterranean in Italy or Greece or somewhere, and the ash from that drifted over the Mediterranean, dropped down into the Nile, and turned it kind of reddish. And of course, you know what happened then? The frogs didn't like it. So out of the water comes all the frogs. And, of course, a frog out of water is not too happy, and so the frog dies, not before stirring up a lot of the lice. And then here come the flies to eat the dead, feast off the dead frogs, and what do the flies do? Naturally, hit all the cattle and the flocks. That produces some pestilence. They also infect the people, so they got boils all over the place. And then to make matters worse, here comes a hailstorm. And then that stirs up the locusts. The locusts come, destroy everything. Then we, of all things, it couldn't get any worse. We have an eclipse of the sun. And it gets dark. And then the firstborn died. But the firstborn died because the way they fed you in Egypt, the firstborn got the first food of the batch. But that first food on the top was the likely ones to spoil. And so they probably got the spoiled food, and then as they dug a little deeper in the pot to give it to others, wasn't as spoiled, and they survived. So there you go. All the miracles explain. But you can see the kind of extreme that you go to for that. Now, what about the Bible? Bible states very simply, God exists and miraculously intervenes in the lives of humankind. And as I said, there are witnesses to some of the miracles, even the modern era. There's some witnesses. But there's one question, and I said, when you're evaluating beliefs, this is one question asked, can a belief be falsified, or can it be proven false? And I've mentioned this before, that yeah, if you successfully create matter from nothing, or if you create life from inanimate stuff, then you can then dismiss the oracle of the creation of the universe, creation of life. You can dismiss that. Nobody's been able to figure out how to do that for some strange reason. It doesn't sound that complicated, huh? But there's also a warning, and this is an important warning, in Deuteronomy 13, verses 1 through 3. This was during the Sinai period. That's a pretty strong warning. If there arises among you a prophet or a dreamer of dreams, and he gives you a sign or a wonder, and the sign or wonder comes to pass of which he spoke to you. In other words, he performs a miracle. And then he says, let us go after other gods, which you have not known, and let us serve them, you shall not listen to the words of the prophet, that dreamer of dreams. For the Lord our God is testing you to know whether you love the Lord your God with all your heart and with all your soul. So you see what he's saying here? God is saying there are miracles performed outside of me. Outside of the church, outside of me, there are miracles that are performed. God allows that on occasion. And he tells you why. Because he's testing you. He's testing you to see if someone comes along and performs a miracle and points you anywhere other than to the God of the Bible. Ignore the miracle and don't follow him. Don't try to dismiss the miracle. It may be a real miracle, but don't follow that person. That's a warning. It was a warning to the ancient Hebrews. It's a warning to us today. All right. So I can get back then. That's why they're materialists. All these people are materialists. That's why they don't want to consider miracles. All right, let's go to the third question. Was there actually an Exodus? Now, I love these quotes. I'll give you a couple quotes here. This is from Israel Finkelstein, archaeologist at Tel Aviv University. Exodus did not happen in the way it is described in the text based on the background of the 15th century B.C. Couldn't happen. Just couldn't happen. Norma Franklin, I'll give women equal rights here, quote a woman. She's an archaeologist at the University of Haifa. I don't believe there was a single event that we can call the Exodus, archaeologically or historically. And then I really love this quote, and I think I've given you this one before in another sermon. This is from Rabbi David Walper, who's the head of one of the largest Jewish congregations in the country. And he says this: the Exodus certainly didn't happen the way the Bible depicted it, assuming that it was an historical event in any description. I think that if you look at it scientifically, it's virtually indefensible to make the Bible's case. But you also have to understand that your faith isn't based on splitting seas or archaeological digs. It's based on something much deeper. And he goes on to say, the extent to which it has an historical core is very hard to say, but my deeper conviction about it is that it's a story that, whether it was true, it is true, and those are two different things. In other words, things that aren't facts can be truths. I love that quote. Kind of reminds me of this politician. It says, I believe in truth and not facts, or something to that effect. But anyway, this is the kind of thinking of people. And you bring up, well, what? How could all these things come together and happen? Well, it was just a coincidence. Which brings me to what I did talk about before, so I just want to mention this briefly. one of the big objections to the Exodus is there's not a hint of Hebrews ever, of any significant number, ever being in Egypt. And I talked about this in my sermons on the history of the Israelites. But there's been a dig going on at Tel Ed-Daba since about 1990 or so. And they've dug down and discovered the ancient city of Avaris. And this is on the screen here is an excavation layout. You know, the way they dig. The deeper they dig, the farther back in time they go. And so when they got down to, you might say, the bottom, where there was nothing left, no artifacts left, they got down to that level, and it was about the 12th and 13th dynasties of Egypt is about what they found at the lowest level. Now, the 12th dynasty was around 1700 to 1600 B.C., and the 13th dynasty, we're moving forward in time as we get higher number of dynasties. 13th dynasty was about 1600 to 1450. So the 12th dynasty was time of Jacob and Joseph. But 13th dynasty ran on into the time of Moses and the Exodus. And so what they found was what they've been finding at Avaris is that there's evidence of a large population of Semitic people. And this large population lived and worked alongside Egyptians, at least in the lowest levels. At this period, they seemed to be of what they describe in the write-ups of the excavations of Syrian types of houses and so forth. And that's where Abraham came from originally, was Syria, that area, what is now Syria. And so they had the characteristics of those kinds of people as opposed to Egyptians. So they appear to be definitely Semitic. And they had the people lived in with the Egyptians for several hundred years. At the end of that period, the Semitic people disappear. Now, at the upper levels, they found the remains of a great palace of Seti I and Ramses II. That they were of the 19th dynasty. So that's moving forward to about the 1200s. So that's what they've been finding there. A lot of evidence that there were a lot of Hebrews there. And they also found this. that there was something happened. There was a period there when instead of the formal, you know, Egyptians were big on proper burials and so forth. There was a period there where they just threw the bodies in graves on top of each other. It was a bad period. And it's described by Egyptologist David Roll this way. All over the city of Avaris, they found shallow burial pits in which the victims of some terrible disaster had been hurriedly cast. There were no careful interments of the deceased. The bodies were not arranged in proper burial fashion, but rather thrown into the mass graves, one on top of the other. There were no grave goods placed within the corpses, with the corpses as the usual custom. So what was happening is these people, something bad happened. And the Hebrews disappeared at that point. And about 100 years later, some Palestinians moved into that area. They called Hyksos. And they moved in, but they were definitely Palestinian, Philistines, basically. But the Hebrews were all gone. And then eventually the Egyptians took back control of it. Now, so that's the background there. All right, so let's look what a quick outline of what the Bible says happened. Basically, the Exodus is described in two books, the Book of Exodus, Book of Numbers. Now, there's some information in Deuteronomy. There's some information in some other books, too. But we get most of the information from these two. So let's take a brief summary of what happened in the Exodus. Exodus 13:17. Then it came to pass when the Pharaoh had let the people go that God did not lead them by the way of the land of the Philistines. Now this is important. Quickest way to Canaan was to head out of Goshen along the parallel to the Mediterranean Sea right into where the Philistines. They were pretty powerful at that time. God said, don't go by the way of the Philistines. And so they weren't led that way. And then Numbers 33:3. They departed from Ramses in the first month, on the 15th day of the first month. On the day after the Passover, the children of Israel went out with boldness in the sight of all the Egyptians. So we know exactly when they left. The first month, 15th day. Right around evening is when they left. You look at more details. So we know that. We have some firm dates in here. So they took off in Exodus 13:18. So God led the people around by the way of the wilderness of the Red Sea. So here's the first mention of the Red Sea as the way that they were heading. What Red Sea? That is the question. Numbers 33:5. Then the children of Israel moved from Ramses and camped at Succoth. And so they start describing these camps, where they camped. The big problem is, and in Exodus 13:20, they say the same thing, they camped to Succoth. Nobody knows where Succoth was. We don't know where any of these places were. We don't even know whether they were cities or not, or towns. Continuing on in Exodus 13:20, so they took their journey from Succoth and camped at Etham in the edge of the wilderness. We don't know where Etham is. Numbers 33:6, they departed from Succoth and camped at Etham, which is on the edge of the wilderness. So all we know about Etham is on the edge of the wilderness. Exodus 14:2, speak to the children of Israel that they turn and camp before Pi-Hahiroth, between Migdal and the sea, opposite Baal-Zephon, and you shall camp there by the sea. Numbers 33:7 says the same thing. They moved from Etham and turned back to Pi-Hahiroth, which is east of Baal-Zephon, and they camped near Migdal. Why did they do that, and where are those things? Like I said, we don't even know whether they're towns. They may be some kind of monuments or something. We don't know. But continuing on here, Exodus 14:3. For the Pharaoh will say to the children of Israel, they are bewildered by the land, and the wilderness has closed them in. So he says, aha, they're trapped. So wherever those places are, Pi-Hahiroth and Migdal, they were trapped there. And Pharaoh went after them. And then 14:21 of Exodus, And the Lord caused the sea to go back by a strong east wind all that night and made the sea into dry land, and the waters divided. And so they crossed through the Red Sea, as described in Numbers 13:8. They departed before Hahiroth and passed through the midst of the sea into the wilderness. And so we have a lot of information here, but we have no idea where these places were. Exodus 15:22. So Moses brought Israel from the Red Sea, and then they went out into the wilderness of Sur, and they went 3 days, and they found no water. So the first thing that happened is they got thirsty. Numbers 11:8, and they went 3 days' journey in the wilderness of Etham and camped by Marah. So the wilderness of Sur, the wilderness of Etham, maybe Etham wasn't a city, maybe it was just a wilderness. It's kind of confusing when you start putting all this together. So that kind of gets us through the crossing of the Red Sea in kind of an outline form. So the Bible says, yeah, it definitely happened, and it was a pretty big miracle when it happened. And then is there a biblical date for the Exodus? And I've talked about this before, so I'm just going to mention this very briefly. There's a lot of evidence to get us down pretty narrowly, but the best evidence is from 1 Kings 6:1, where it says in the fourth year of King Solomon's reign that they begin to build the temple. And they also says, and that was 480th year since they left the Exodus. So if we know Solomon's dates of Solomon's reign, we can pin this baby down. And scholars have a pretty good idea, they claim. They think it was that Solomon's rule began 971 or 970 B.C., one or the other. Right at that period of time, they've narrowed it down. And they feel pretty confident about that. Because it's not only the Bible and looking at that, but they're looking at the Assyrian records, Egyptian records, Babylonian records. They're looking at all these other records, and they kind of can zero in. There's certain dates, like the fall of Thebes in Egypt. That's a big, colossal thing that happened that's recorded in various places, in various different countries. And so by taking this information and putting it all together, they feel like this is a pretty good date for the beginning of his reign. So if we take 971 B.C. as the first year of Solomon's reign, we have to go take off 4 years. Remember, B.C. time moves forward, the years are moving downward. So we have to track off four to get to the fourth year of Solomon's reign. And now we want to go back 480 years to get to the date of the Exodus, and we get to 1447 as the date of the Exodus. And let's see, since this is 2021, we add 2021 to 1447. Subtract 1 year off because there's no year zero, and we're approaching the 3,467th anniversary of the Exodus. Let's say give or take a year or two. We're right in that area. The other thing that I'll mention briefly is the New York Times article that described the excavations of Jericho. A lot of excavations of Jericho occurred before 1950, back in the early 1900s. And they set a date for Jericho's fall much earlier than the Exodus. This more modern excavation sets the date at around 1400 of the fall of Jericho. We add 40 years to that to go back to when they left Egypt. We're talking about around 1440 or so. So we're getting some good collaboration that we can pin that date down to a few years, around 1447. Let's say mid-1400s is a pretty good range for that. So, yeah, so we do have a date. Now the question of Ramses. Genesis 47:11. Was Ramses the Pharaoh of the Exodus, Genesis 47:11, and Joseph situated his father and his brothers and gave them possession of the land of Egypt and the best of the land in the land of Ramses, as Pharaoh commanded. Problem was, Ramses didn't live for 600 years later. So what's this, the land of Ramses? Did Ramses II have a great-great-great-great-grandfather, Ramses, that nobody mentioned? Well, let's go on a minute here. Exodus 1:11. Therefore they set taskmasters over them to afflict them and their burdens, and they built Pharaoh's supply cities, Pithom and Ramses. Now, wait a minute. They moved to Ramses, and then they built Ramses? It sounds kind of confusing here. Exodus 12:37. Then the children of Israel journeyed from Ramses to Succoth, about 600,000 men on foot besides children. All right, now we've jumped 400 years, and they're journeying from Ramses. Did Ramses live 400 years? You see the problems here. Numbers 33:3, they departed from Ramses in the first month. That's what they're talking about. But the palace of Ramses built, the city that became Ramses, that wasn't built. The Ramses ruled in like the 1200s B.C., long after they had disappeared. So what was going on here? Well, what happened was everybody knew where the city of Ramses was in the 6th century B.C., when the copyists kind of finalized the Old Testament as we have it today. And so they used the name Ramses because everybody knew that, because the remains were well known. Avaris had long since disappeared and were buried. So that ties into where the Hebrews live in the city of Ramses. And so the conventional dates for Ramses' reign was 1279 to 1213 B.C., Remember, the Exodus dated around 1447. Joseph settled in the land of Ramses hundreds of years before there was a Ramses. So clearly they were using the landmark at the time they were editing the Bible. And we know that Ramses couldn't have been the one, because he describes on the Israel Stela that Egypt was at war against the Canaanite cities. And the quote on that stela is that Canaan has been plundered into every sort of woe. Ascalon has been overcome. Gezer has been captured. Yoam was made non-existent. Israel was laid waste. His seed is not. They tend to exaggerate on these things. But you see the point here. Ramses, the children of Israel had been in Canaan and established for a long time when he attacked them. So certainly that was not the case. This was just a matter of some editing of the Bible, and they believe it around the 6th century when the Old Testament was finalized, and that they put in some names that people would know. Too bad they didn't put in some of the names of these other cities, and we can kind of figure out the path of the Exodus. All right, so this brings us to number 7. Of the questions, and the last of the questions we'll address today. How many Hebrews departed in the Exodus? Well, it's confusing. Numbers 2:32, and you know why the book of Numbers is named the book of Numbers? Because they give a lot of numbers, okay? And they give a lot of confusing numbers. All right, Numbers 2:32, these are the ones who were numbered of the children of Israel by their fathers' houses. All who were numbered according to the armies of the forces, and notice that, according to the armies of the forces, were 603,550. A little over 600,000. Now, these were males 20 and over of the armies of the forces. So the implication here, if you read the other scriptures surrounding the census, is that it may not have included every male over 20, but the ones that were capable in some way of serving with the armies. But we don't know how many that would have been that were excluded. Like, you know, the old guys that are kind of decrepit like I am, 79. You know, another year I'll be as old as Moses was when he went back to Egypt. That's kind of scary. The number's nice. It gives us a kind of a thing to work with, but we just don't know. We just don't know everything. But there's some interesting things we can look at here. Numbers 339. Now, there's one tribe they didn't count, the tribe of Levi. Numbers 339, all who were numbered of the Levites, whom Moses and Aaron numbered at the commandment of the Lord by families, all the males from 1 month old and above were 22,000. So they numbered the rest of the tribes, and there was 12 because the tribe of Joseph was divided into two, Ephraim and Manasseh. And so they had the 12 tribes and then the Levites. And they counted them differently. They counted the Levites from a month old up. And there were only 22,000. And these were males again. You know, women didn't seem to rate much attention in ancient Israel. They didn't even count them. But they did have their role. Now, what does this mean? If you take, let's use the 603,000 of the 12 tribes, over 20. You divide that number by 12, you come up to about 50,000 per tribe on the average. But yet, not just the over 20, but the entire Levites, it seems to be saying, were only 22,000. I'm going to show you in a minute, it's likely that for those 603,550 males, that there were likely about that many females, and there were likely about that many children. And we'll look at that more in detail. But yet it says there were only 22,000 Levites. Yeah, that seems strange. It's a mystery. Nobody has figured that out, and I haven't either, so don't get your hopes up here. All right, so we have these two numbers to work with: males 20 and older, 600, a little over 600,000; the Levites 1 month and older, around 22,000. All right, let's go to Exodus 1, verse 7. But the children of Israel were fruitful and increased abundantly, multiplied and grew exceedingly mighty, and the land was filled with them. Here's where the women came in. They were highly productive in terms of children. Now, I started doing a little searching here to figure out some things. And I looked at the U.S. Census. I looked at different years of the U.S. Census, but looking like from around the last half century or so, in that range, in the U.S. Census, about 25% of the adult population was under 20. And also, the average birth rates for women have hovered around about 2 since 1975. Now, in recent years, it's actually dropped down to about 1. But for most of this time, is around 2. And that produced about 25% under 25. So the Israelites were probably averaging somewhere between 8 to 10 births rather than 2 births per woman. So let's take that 8, just because it's a nice round number. 8 versus 2, that's a factor of 4. So if you apply that factor of 4 to that 25%, that would say that there were about 100% of the adult Israelites, and there were that many children in addition. Now, if we take that, the adults, we can throw in 600,000, use round numbers here, 600,000 men. We expect to be at least 600,000 women, about thereabouts. And then an additional equal number of children. That would give a total of about 2.4 million Israelites when they left Egypt, according to this census. Now, This doesn't include the Levites. It seems to be a small number. It doesn't include those too old to do it, those that are over the hill. It doesn't seem to include those. So this is, you might say, kind of the lower bound of how many people left Egypt. Now, I went back to the 1800 U.S. Census and the 1900 U.S. Census to get a better feel for this. And so I looked at the 1800, the 0 to 19, the number of males were about 1.23 million. The number 20 and up were 0.91 million. So there are more children. I'm using the definition of children if you're 19 and under. There are more children than there were adults in 1800. You go to 1900, it flips a little bit. By this time, the children were about almost 17 million, the adults were about 20 million, so it flipped. So 57 to 43 is now 45 to 55. So somewhere in between 1800 and 1900, we had this period where they would be about equal. I didn't go through all the census, but that's not a bad estimate is what I'm saying, because 1800s, 1900s, my grandparents, early 1900s, they had 9 kids, 7 boys and 2 girls. So, you know, that's getting on up into Israelite range. All right, so I did it another way. I looked at population growth rates, calling year zero the year that they went into Egypt, and the 70 people that came in, and using a growth rate of 2.5%, and I'll show you why I use that in a minute, but that's the kind of growth rate back in the 1900, that's the kind of growth rates we're hitting. I'll show you that in a minute. but I plug this in and see what kind of population would we get, and in 430 years, we'd get about 2.8 million people. Okay, so I said, all right, as a minimum, 2.4 million. By using this growth rate, we'd get 2.8 million. So we're in the ballpark here. That's what I'm saying. We're in the ballpark. Now, I found this interesting. When we look at these numbers, the population at 390 years after they came into Egypt, and that would have been when Moses fled Egypt the first time at the 390 mark, the population was around 1.07, a little over a million. He comes back 40 years later, population is 2.4, 2.8 million. At least according to this chart, it'd be about 2.8 million. And by the way, you see I put in parentheses here, if I used the growth rate of 2.46%, it would have come out 2.4 million. But I didn't want to cheat on you. I just kind of picked a nice round number and did it and then say, but now look at this. This is the U.S. growth rate, 1800, 1900, 1950, 2000. It was about 2 2/3, about 2.67 in 1800. So it was greater than this. By 1900, you can see it had dropped to about 2 and 2.5 or something like that. So sometime between 1800 and 1900, that's when the population was hitting at about 2.5. So this is a pretty reasonable growth rate. So I think we can say from this that, yeah, it was probably around 2.4, 2.8, throw in some extra for the those that weren't counted, the Levites, it might get up to 3 million. I know in Clark's commentary, they come up with a little over 3 million in the way they juggle the figures. But that gives you a pretty good idea. Now, arguments against such a large number. There's always people say, you're crazy. It couldn't have been more than 20,000, comes out. They say it's too large because there's no archaeological evidence Hebrews were ever in Egypt. Well, I've shown you that there is now. There wasn't up until the recent years. The second argument, they couldn't have made it across the desert. I'll address that in another sermon. The third was there was a mistranslation in the Hebrew. Ah, here we go. the word thousand, elef, is translated 1,000 in the Old Testament over 400 times. But 7 times is translated differently. And this is what they hang their hat on. And whoops, gone too far here. 7 times, I've listed them all here. You know, Judges, Isaiah, Psalms, Deuteronomy. They either cattle, oxen, flood, or family. 7 times they use this. Obviously, they're talking about a large number when they're referring to these things. All right, but they jump on this and they say, okay, here's the breakdown of how the tribes were counted. 12 tribes. The first one, I forget which one it was, 46,500. They say, no, that's not what this means. What this means is there were 46 units. They say, well, thousands really means units. There were 46 units totaling 500. And then there were 59 units totaling 300 and so forth. And if you took it that way, you come out with about 5,550 men. Or if you double that for the women and then double it again for the children, you come around 20,000 or so. And they say, ah, now that's more like it. So that's the that's the main argument they use to dispute these large numbers. But I think we need to look at it from a different perspective. We need to look at it from Egypt's perspective, too. In Egypt's perspective, it said, this is a quote from a first century B.C. writer, Diodorus Siculus. It said that the reign of Amasis was a time of unexampled material property for Egypt. The river gave its riches to the earth gave it to the people, and the total number of inhabited towns was, they say, 20,000. In the density of population, Egypt was far surpassed of old all known regions of the inhabited world, and even in our own day, it is thought to be second to none other. For in ancient times, it had over 18,000 important villages and cities, as can be seen, entered in their sacred records, while under Ptolemy I, these were reckoned at over 30,000. This great number continued down to our time. The total population, they say, of old was about 7 million. And the numbers remained no less than that day. So there's one estimate, 7 million. Josephus says there were 7.5 million men. And maybe that's what Diodorus was referring to. But he says 750,000, or 7.5 million men. Now, let's look at some of these population estimates and see how they fit. I'm going to talk about the population of Egypt versus the population of Israel. I'm taking the kind of the higher and lower estimates here. Now, if you take both low estimates, Egypt 3.5 million, the Israelites about 20,000, that'd make Israelites about 0.5% of the population. Is that going to scare anybody? Probably not. So I don't think that's the right one. But if we take the low Egyptian estimate and the high Israelite estimate, that's 2/3. Now, long before 2/3, the Egyptians are going to be scared half to death. So that doesn't sound right. So let's take the high of 7.5 million for the Egypt and the 20,000. Again, that's only 2.27, a quarter of a percent. That's not going to scare anybody. But if we take the high, 7.5 million versus 2.4 million, that's about 32%, about a third. They would have been worried long before that. So I like Josephus's number here of about 30 million. 7.5 million males, an equal number of females would get us to 15 million. And if there's that many children also, that would get us up to 30 million. 2.4 million is about 8%. That would be getting up into the time that the Egyptians would probably be getting concerned. So it seems to fit. That's the point I'm making here. So logic points to the Bible as being pretty accurate when it gets down to it. Now, here's an interesting thing. Numbers 26:2. Now we're at the end of the 40-year period. God said, take another census. Numbers 26:2. Take a census of all the congregations of Israel from 20 years old and above by their father's houses, all who are able to go to war in Israel. Kind of the same kind of thing they said 40 years earlier. So Moses and Eleazar the priest spoke with them in the plains of Moab by the Jordan, they're getting ready to go in, across from Jericho, saying, take a census of the people from 20 years old and above, just as the Lord commanded Moses and the children of Israel who came out of the land of Egypt. Okay, so they took another census. We drop down to Numbers 26, verse 51. These are those who were numbered of the children of Israel, 601,730. What's going on here? 40 years later, the numbers haven't changed. Around 600,000 males. What happened? What's going on here? And it's the same thing with the Levites. They counted the Levites from 1 month up, and instead of 22,000, they got 23,000. What was going on? What happened to all the Israelites? Had the same number. Over 40 years, basically the population didn't change. Now, let's go back to my chart, and I've added one more column. Instead of 0 to 430 years, I've added 40 more years, which would put us in the point of going into the land of Canaan. There should have been around 7.7 million people by that time. And instead, they're about the same by this chart, 2.8 million. If you want to use my minimum figure, about 2.4 million. But the population didn't change. The population didn't change. Now, at least until I heard the sermonette, there were two things that had to happen for this to occur. First of all, the birth rate must have gone way down. And second of all, the people must have died prematurely. The people in this 20 to 60 year range, that 40 year range, the people from 20 upward, they all had to die. And so they must have, a lot of them must have died prematurely. Okay, now, I now have a new theory. For this to happen, they had to die early because they all had to die out in 40 years. Now, the person that's 20 at the Exodus, he's going to have to be dead by 60 unless he's Joshua or Caleb. Yeah, that's not too old. Matter of fact, he's getting younger all the time from my perspective. But so they had to die early. But that wouldn't be enough in itself. Birth rate has to go way down. And now I figured out why. Mr. Sanders, he didn't realize what he was telling me. But not only did that manna contain all the nutrients they needed, it must have contained some birth control. That's my theory. That's my new theory. Thank you, Mr. Sanders, for opening my mind to that. But getting back to more serious stuff. Obviously, they were not very reproductive during that period of time. Clearly, so God's hand was there. But I looked at the 1900 census because they gave a good breakdown, and about 73%. Of the population from 20 to 60 had died over that 40-year period. And so if we took that, that means that about 27% had not died over that 40-year period. So if we took 27% multiplied by 1.2 million, we'd come out with about 325,000. Again, I'm just using round numbers here, which would have meant that about a third of a million more died in the wilderness than would normally be expected. So there was there was lots of things going on. They weren't reproducing, and a lot of people were dying sooner than they should. Now, I want to conclude with one more thing here. Exodus 1, verses 8 through 14, going back to how productive the Israelites were, in spite of some hardships before the Exodus. There arose a new king over Egypt who did not know Joseph, and he said to his people, "Look, the people of the children of Israel are more and mightier than we. Come, let us deal shrewdly with them, lest they multiply and it happen in the event of war that they also join our enemies and fight against us so that they go up out of the land." Therefore, they set taskmasters over them to afflict them with their burdens. They built for Pharaoh the supply cities of Pithom and Ramses, which you just read about. But the more they afflicted them, the more they multiplied. They were like rabbits. And they were in dread of the children of Israel. So the Egyptians made the children of Israel serve with rigor, and they made their lives bitter with hard bondage and mortar and bricks. You know all the stories. And in all of the manner of service in the field, all their services which they made them were served with vigor. But it didn't work. Continuing on in Exodus 1, verse 15. Then the kings of king of Egypt spoke to the Hebrew midwives, of whom the name of one was Shiphrah, and the other was Puach. And he said, "When you do the duties of a midwife for the Hebrew women and see them on the birth stools, if it's a son, you shall kill him, but if it's a daughter, then she shall live." But the midwives feared God and did not do as the king of Egypt commanded, but they saved the male children alive. So that the king of Egypt called for the midwives and said to them, "Why have you done this and saved the male children alive?" And I love this statement. The midwife said to the Pharaoh, "Because the Hebrew women are not like the Egyptian women, for they are lively and give birth before the midwives come to them." So you're like, you women, your ancestors were very lively. But see, nothing stopped them, except when they got out into the wilderness for 40 years. Exodus 1, verse 20. "Therefore God dealt with them, with the midwives, and the people multiplied and grew very mighty. And so it was, because the midwives feared God, that he provided households for them." We don't know who these midwives were. But it sounds like maybe they were kind of Egyptians that were overseeing these kind of things. Egyptians were very methodical. They kept lots of records and stuff. And they were probably recording births and doing all kinds of things. And it may have been them, but anyway, they were protected. Probably went out with the Israelites, even. But they were protected. But my last question here, my last slide, too. Did you ever wonder why God was so angry with not just the Pharaoh, but with the Egyptians? Why take it out on the Egyptians? It was the Pharaoh that was the problem, wasn't it? Well, Exodus 1, verse 21. "So Pharaoh commanded all his people, saying, 'Every son who is born, you shall cast into the river, and every daughter you shall save alive.'" Moses was saved from that. So what happened? The Pharaoh ordered genocide. Those midwives didn't obey, but the people of Egypt did. And that probably cut down on the population that would have left otherwise. Certainly, it's cut down to a certain extent. But you can see what happened here. That God, as long as God was blessing them, they continued to multiply. Once God turned off the blessings, they were just level. It was like 40 years passed, and nothing had changed in terms of their numbers. They were starting like they would have started 40 years earlier if they had obeyed. Now, God can turn off the blessing spigot just like that, and he certainly did for the Israelites. All right, well, that's it for today. We will come next time I speak, we will look at the rest of these questions and talk about them.